Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Members, first on the agenda was Representative Carlson, but he is stuck in traffic and will be here, I understand, shortly, so we'll go slightly out of order. So we will take Representative Smith's House File 1461. Representative Smith, you want to introduce your bill, please?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to. There is an amendment before you. I believe it's AO70255. First of all, I'd like to move the bill.
Ms. Representative Smith, we're going to not move your bill right now because we don't have a quorum, but we'll hear your bill and we'll move it as soon as we have a quorum.
And at that point, I'd request the chair lay it over for possible inclusion. In advance of that, Mr. Chairman, we have an amendment, AO70255. I would like, when you have a quorum, to move the amendment. And I would also like to make an oral amendment when you have a quorum to the amendment.
Okay.
I will briefly discuss the amendment, excuse me, and the oral amendment. If you would just look at page 3 of the amendment that's before you, section 2, dealing with an effective date of January 1, 2008. When the time is right, Mr. Chair, I'd ask orally that that section be deleted because I'm informed that's redundant. It's not needed. And the effect of the amendment itself would be to set the percent of the new interest rate at 10%. With that, I'm going to ask Mr. Joel Carlson of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association to inform you and the committee what this bill would do.
So, Representative Smith, is your intent to delete section 2 of the on page 3?
Chairman, yes, to delete line 3.4 through 3.6, I believe.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, do you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. With me is Chris Messerly, who's the president of the MTLA. And just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Minnesota has a floor on its pre- and post-judgment interest rate that is the lowest in the country. It's set at 4%. It fluctuates, and over the past 10 years, it has, I think, had an excursion above 4% very infrequently. I don't know, it's not recommended bedtime reading, Mr. Chairman, but I do have an analysis of all 50 states and their pre- and post-judgment interest rates. I would say that they range from an average of about 8% to a high of 18% in Texas on contract cases. In working with the courts, they calculate the interest rate once per year. They do it in December, and that's why we can delete the effective date. They will reset it in December of this year for judgments that are docketed or awarded after January 1 of 2008. With that, I ask Mr. Messerly to just provide some brief comments and be happy to answer any questions that you might have and appreciate your consideration.
Mr. Messerly, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Messerly. I live in Vadnais Heights, and I practice law in Minneapolis and have for 20 years. I'm the president of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association, and I'd like to just give an example of the impact of our interest rate here. I had a case in which I represented a severely brain-damaged mother, a young mother with children. We tried that case and prevailed. And primarily because of this interest rate, the defendant responsible for harming her delayed and delayed and appealed for over 2 years, despite the fact that they knew they would not prevail. In the meantime, this poor woman rotted in a nursing home, did not get the care she deserved, and all of us as taxpayers paid her a very significant medical expenses. When it was all over and we prevailed, we were paid, but because of this interest rate, since many corporations are in business to earn profit, they quite frankly, from an economic standpoint, realized the fact that it would be foolish to be responsible for the judgment because they could invest their money and earn far more in the market than they could ever earn with Minnesota's interest rate. So it's people that suffer, by the way, this would apply to a corporation. If 3M brought a claim and prevailed, the corporation responsible for harming 3M would have the same economic interests not to pay. So it really doesn't matter who the prevailing party is. So that's just a real-world example of how it harms these people. Whereas in Wisconsin, where I'm licensed to practice, where the interest rate, like most many states, is 12%, there are no frivolous appeals. If there's not a good basis for appeal, the matter is paid, and it is kept out of the courts, and the matter is finally resolved. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Messerly, have you done an analysis of how we rank vis-a-vis all the states, or
yes.
Is it just Wisconsin?
No, yes, sir, I have. The interest rates vary dramatically. I could walk through all 50.
No, that's okay. Just,
without doing that, I will tell you that the lowest I see is a 5% or 6%. That's only in one or two states. The highest is 18%. There's a 15%. I would say the vast majority are in the vicinity of 10 to 12%. There's a number of 8% as well. But there are really no states, hardly at all, anywhere near Minnesota's. And I have the 50-state analysis here.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to testify, is there any correlation between the number of appeals and the interest rate? If you have an analysis of the interest rates, I would assume that there's a corresponding analysis of appeals to interest rate. And what does that say?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biskins, what we do know is that the Court of Appeals is experiencing a significant increase in cases that are taken to the court. They're asking for three additional appellate court judges just to handle the caseload. How many of those are tied to a favorable interest rate, I cannot tell you, but we do know that their workload has greatly expanded for a variety of reasons, this possibly being one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carlson, so there is no data one way or the other that at least at the very broadest level compares interest rates to number of appeals?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, and Rips and Biskins, that number will not be available, and the reason why is they don't take an appeal based on the interest rate. They take an appeal based on a trial error, based on other legal issues that they take an appeal over. You would never get to a number of a defendant saying, I'm only doing this because the interest rate is 4%. That's an unknowable number.
Represent this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then, Mr. Carlson, I guess I'd caution you to use in your testimony the reason for raising the interest rate is to minimize the number of frivolous appeals. If there is, you're telling me there's no tie, there's no connect, then I guess in your, as this bill moves forward, I'll caution you on using that in your testimony.
Mr. Carl.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Biskins, I've been around here a long time. We know by anecdotal evidence that happens, but your question was, is there a statistical number? And that's my response. No, there is not, but we certainly know by anecdotal evidence that it's there, and I've had a number of issues based on anecdotes around here that's what we experience.
Representative Smith, we now have a quorum. If you would move the 0255 amendment, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would like to move the AO7-0255 amendment to get it before the committee. And in doing that, I would like to offer an oral amendment. Specifically, that would be on page 3, section 2, lines 3.4 through 3.6. I would move that portion of the written amendment be deleted.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the amendment prevails.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move the amendment as amended.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak in favor of the bill or against the bill?
Mr. Chairman, if not, I would also represent to the committee that the amendment represents discussion and compromise between the trial lawyers and the court representative.
there any discussion of the bill before us? Well, that then the chair will lay over House File 1461 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Messerly, thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Smith.
The chairman, thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 950, Representative Carlson. And Representative Carlson, I understand you have an amendment to for your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The chair will move House File 950 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Carlson, do you want to explain your amendment so we can get it in the shape that you want it?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment that you have in your packet would reflect action in the Finance Committee yesterday, which essentially restored the funding, which is what this bill is about, and I'll explain in a moment, to the Hennepin County Courts for the per diem that's distributed as a result of bail cancellations.
Okay. The chair will...
Or the bail is distributed...
The chair will move that we, on page 2, we delete section 2 of the bill to get the bill in the shape that the author wants. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails. Representative Carlson, present your bill, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is to restore certain bail proceeds that previously had been statutorily earmarked to the municipalities in Hennepin County. And the background is that during the 2006 legislature, the judicial branch pursued cleanup legislation to remove obsolete references and provisions. That bill was added to the omnibus bill, and an incorrect repealer in the omnibus bill led to the unintentional repeal of the 1963 law that was unique to Hennepin County. The repeal law required Hennepin County District Court to disperse non-felony forfeited bail to the municipality in which the offense occurred. Since July 2006, these bail proceeds have been mistakenly credited to the general fund. A companion 1963 law that was not repealed requires the municipalities in Hennepin County to pay the Hennepin County Workhouse for the incarceration of misdemeanors. The bail proceeds were intended to help the municipalities pay these incarceration costs. So the solution that's before you is to restore and update the repealed 1963 law. And as I mentioned yesterday, the first step was taken in finance to deal with this biennium. And so the bill that's now before you would correct that error in the repealer and allow the cancellations of bail to be distributed to those municipalities where the crime took place. So with that, I'll mention that I've got Mark S. Simpson with me, who represents or is the judicial district administrator for Hennepin County.
Representative Carlson, before you begin, Representative Lilly, always the sharp eye here, caught something. I think we misstated one part of your amendment, if I understand this correctly. We also should have deleted lines 16 and 17, so the effective date would be July 1, 2007. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's what I have here.
Okay, and we neglected to say that. I neglected to say that, and we only deleted Section 2 on appropriation. So I'm going to make that amendment so we get this clear. So the amendment is to delete lines on page 2, deletes line 16 and 17 and insert Section 1 is effective July 1st, 2007. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment prevails. Sorry about that, Representative Carlson. And your presenter is?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning.
I'm Mark Thompson, the court administrator for Hennepin County. This is a unique situation to Hennepin County. It does not affect the other 86 counties because in 1963, and I know some of you have heard this before, the workhouse, the jail, was sold by the city to the county for a dollar. In consideration for that, the municipalities then agreed to pay for misdemeanor overnight stays on misdemeanor cases. This is unique and unusual to Hennepin only. No other county municipalities pay this. As a quid pro quo, the bail forfeitures on misdemeanor cases were a partial offset to that cost. I'm not sure what the thinking was in this room or others in 1963 when this agreement was forged, but I know that it has worked effectively for 44 years until we mistakenly repealed it last year and 47 municipalities were offering a noose to hang me. So today I'm here to support this correction and hope that the committee will find it to be the right thing to do. Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, could other workhouses, could other counties try this experiment out now that we're opening it up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be an interesting experiment. I think the Hennepin County Department of Correction, or Community Corrections Department, collects about $1.2 million for their overnight stays from the municipalities that put people in jail there. These are only misdemeanors, nothing above. They get back, these municipalities, about $250,000 a year in bail forfeitures from the bill that's before you, or that was repealed last year. So it's about a 4-to-1 on the downside. It might have made sense 34 or 44 years ago in terms of how the money came out, but it doesn't. It's kind of lopsided right now. So this is kind of a minimal consideration for the $1.1 million they're paying in misdemeanor jail fees, because the costs of running a jail have gone up so much for the last 4 years.
Representative Smith, do you recall? I mean, this happened last year with the omnibus bill. Why or how this provision got repealed? I don't want to put you on the spot, but I just... Do you know, Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, I vaguely remember, but I'm going to let the presenter give you the appropriate answer.
Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, thank you. We did a cleanup bill for the courts, which was kind of a consolidated statewide bill, eliminating county court language, which was no longer applicable due to the merger or state funding provisions that occurred over the last 20 years. This was a drive-by shooting victim in that bill. It became, we thought it wasn't going to be included through revisions of committee drafts. It became included by accident. I can assure you I will read every one of those at the end of the year before the committees approve these, because I can't believe how much time all of us have spent correcting this.
Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in our packet there was a fiscal note to this bill also. Is the effect of the amendment to make the fiscal note null and void?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, no, the fiscal note still stands. There is a cost to, as you see on that fiscal note, of, I believe, $240,000 in 08 and again in 09.
Senator Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Carger, changing the effective date from a retroactive July 1st of 2006 to a prospective date of July 1st, 2007 has no fiscal impact?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, I think what this amendment did, it clarified what was done in the Finance Committee yesterday, where they funded the deficiency for fiscal year 2007. So they took care of the $240,000 there, and now what this bill does, it ongoing for fiscal year 08 on.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then this fiscal note, Mr. Chair, is more to a different bill that was dealt with in finance and not to this bill itself, because this bill is prospective?
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskins, no, it is this bill. I mean, this. Maybe I'm not explaining. Maybe Mr. Thompson can explain it a little,
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Biskin, our intent was to go back and correct the wrong we had created. We took this money. There was no fiscal note last year because there was no consideration this was going to occur. It did by accident in policy. I followed the policy as the court administrator, so we didn't give them the money. We went back to correct that previously, and now we're back to proactively correct it for the future. So there's two different pieces to this. There was what we did and what we're going to do. We corrected what we did, and now this is to correct what we're going to do, or will do, short of changing this.
Is there any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I have Ron Weiberg here as well, and if he could comment a bit about how the situation is handled in the other counties. I think that this law is unique to Hennepin County, but I think it's important to understand how the other workhouses and so on are funded, so if you could comment briefly.
Sure. Mr. Weiberg?
Mr. Chairman, Ron Weiberg, Hennepin County Community Corrections Department. In response to your question about, you know, other jurisdictions possibly entertaining this idea, as Mr. Thompson and Representative Carlson indicated, this is a very unique situation for Hennepin County, which predates all of us. You know, we tried to find somebody that was in the legislature in 1963 to get some rationale for this policy, that, but nobody's found anymore. So we decided that, as Mr. Thompson indicated, that we need to correct the situation. A policy longstanding, an agreement that was worked out. In fact, it was actually in place before the Hennepin County Board took over the workhouse. It was in place when Minneapolis ran the workhouse, so it predates 1963. Other jurisdictions around the state and the other 86 counties, when a municipality prosecutes a misdemeanor case and there's a finding of guilt and there's a subsequent sentence of jail time or workhouse time, those municipalities do not pay the county sheriff for the jails or the workhouses. This is strictly a Hennepin County situation that, as I said, predates all of us. So if any other jurisdictions are contemplating, well, maybe my county or my counties could get into this and possibly get some jail forfeiture money, it is not a winning situation because, as Mr. Thompson indicated, the municipalities draw about $240,000 or $250,000 a year from this revenue source, but they're paying out $1.2 million. So it's not a moneymaker.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Anything else you want to add, Representative Carlson?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that completes our presentation.
Okay, Representative Carlson is chair of the Finance Committee. You can see the enormity and gravity of our financial situation here, and we will certainly consider your bill. I think it's needed for Hennepin County to correct the situation, but I think you can see the problem that we're facing, and we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Okay, next up, Representative Lash. Before we start with your bill, Representative Lesh, just wanted to make an announcement to the committee that if you've looked at the schedule, you can see that in Chair Mullery's committee there are many, many bills that are waiting for to be heard, and some of those bills also have to be heard in this committee. So I talked this over briefly with Representative Smith this morning. I'm hoping members will accommodate a joint meeting or two with Chair Mullery's committee so we can hear those bills, not formally act on them. They will be then referred to our committee, and then hopefully we don't have to do much but then lay them over, if that's okay, just to try to maximize time given the deadlines that we're facing. So, and we're thinking about a Friday afternoon meeting. So,
we're not yet. Yeah. No, you have to get that. We'll get our work done.
Okay, I need someone to approve the minutes of February 27th.
Okay.
No, 28th. All these. These two.
So moved.
February 22nd, March 6th, and March 8th. Representative Zellers has moved those minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? minutes are approved. Representative Lesh, you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I did, I actually just wanted to alert the committee to the fact of two letters that you also have in our committee packets today. One from myself, one from Judge Mary Louise Kloss, regarding requests for information we had on a previously mentioned bill. So thank you for copying these off and having them together for this, Mr. Chair. But if members look in their packet, they can answer some of those questions that were had on the St. Paul Domestic Violence Framework bill. Then, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, to House File 1510, this bill replaces $20 million that was lost in federal funding.
Mr. Representative Lesh, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would. I would move the 1510 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, and what I would do is, Jerry Boisvert is here to essentially explain briefly what was lost and in what areas. So if it's okay with the Chair, I would have her speak to the bill.
Ms. Boisvert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While this is not an agency bill, nor is in the governor's budget, we were asked to just clarify the reduction in grant funds we've had over the last several years. From 2004 to 2007, there has been about a reduction from $24 million to $17 million. This has been predominantly in the BURN program, which has been cut by 64%. There's also been about a 37% cut in our juvenile justice funds, which concerns us.
What is, Ms. Boisvert, what is the total dollar amount? Is this the total dollar amount that has been cut, or to...
Not exactly. The cuts, and this is on an annual basis, from 24.1 million to 17.6 from 2004 to 2007. Most of these cuts have been sustained on the law enforcement and community and juvenile justice side. Fortunately, the crime victim funds have not been reduced.
And what is the impact of these reductions? Are programs simply not getting funded, or are they just getting cut back? Can you give us some real-life examples?
Both of those things happened. We have eliminated crime prevention programming. We have eliminated some support that we had for the BIND program. We had to reduce funding for the drug task forces, for problem-solving courts or drug courts. So it had significant cuts in the community.
Are there any questions of Ms. Boisvert or Representative Lesh? Any further comments, Representative Lesh?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So we will lay House File 1510 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Ms. Boisvert. Thank you, Representative Lesh. And the final bill on our calendar is House File 693. Also, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 693 for possible inclusion.
Is there an amendment to this?
I believe the amendment had already been included, Mr. Chair, but let me just take a look here.
Sorry. What's the DE one? Is that?
Oh, you do. I'm sorry. Yes. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I guess I would move the... E1 amendment. Mr. Chair, I have with me Travis Schwantes with the Washington County Public Defender's Office. He can explain.
Let's make sure we get this right here.
Okay.
So, does everyone have a copy of the DE1 amendment? Okay. So Representative Lesh moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Representative Disney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and I fully intend on voting for the DE-1 amendment, as it is the author's prerogative, and I do always respect that. I guess I do want to know, prior to voting, so that I keep everything straight, is the fiscal note written to the bill as drafted or to the DE-1 amendment?
Mr. Kreiser.
Thank you,
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins. I believe Mr. Schwantes can probably answer that specifically.
And your name again, sir?
Mr. Chair, my name is Travis Schwantes, S-C-H-W-A-N-T-E-S. I'm the managing attorney of the Public Defender's Office located in Stillwater in Washington County.
Okay. Do you want to answer that question about the fiscal impact of the amendment?
Sure. I've reviewed the fiscal note, which is dated February 27th of this year, and I've also reviewed the DE-1 amendment, and there are some significant changes that would affect the fiscal note. Specifically, the original bill was set up to allow for a four-year period of installment payments, so four separate payments. So the collection of the reinstatement fee would be spread over 4 years. The DE-1 amendment on page 2, starting with lines 2.29, changes that to allow for only a two-year period of paying the reinstatement fee in two equal installments with a handling charge on each installment. So that's the one significant change. And then the other change with this amendment is on page 3, starting at line 3.4, it adds a section that states that while somebody's making an installment payment, while they're under an installment agreement, should they receive another revocation for picking up another DUI offense, they're not going to be allowed to enter into a second installment plan until they finish payments under the first installment plan. So that's what the amendment does. As far as how that affects the fiscal note, I think it's very significant. And actually, as I say that, I'm realizing I missed the third big change in the amendment, and that's also on page 2, at line 2.30 and 2.31. The significant change, and this is the most significant change, is that it allows for the people to take advantage of this installment plan to only be people who the court certifies as being financially eligible for a public defender under section 611.17, and that's the public defender eligibility statute. And that statute says that you only get a public defender if you're financially unable to retain counsel. And what that means for most DUIs is if you're unable to pay $500 to $1,000 for a first offense DUI to retain private counsel, you get a public defender. And so what that means is that the assumption in the fiscal note, bullet point, the third bullet point, where it talks about assuming total DWI reinstatements of 29,000 each year remaining constant, that's not going to happen. The whole point of this bill is that those DUI reinstatements get increased, and the people who are going to reinstate that previously didn't reinstate are going to be the people that qualify under this bill. That's my clients, public defender clients, who are now going to be able to benefit from this. So the actual number of reinstatements are going to increase. The fourth bullet point assumption, where it talks about 75% of all DWI, drunk driving revocations, being able to choose the payment option, that's not going to happen either. The reason for that clearly is that not everybody that gets a DUI revocation would be eligible for this. Again, only the people that qualify for a public defender. And while my office, the statistics, you get different statistics. On average, we probably represent about 80% of everybody accused of a crime. But when it comes to DUIs, drunk driving, DWI offenses, that number is substantially less. And I think that number is closer to about 50%. So we don't represent as many DUI clients as we do other clients. So, number one, you only qualify if you get a public defender for this reinstatement option. So I think the amount of people that are going to be able to avail themselves of this option are going to be significantly the people who simply don't reinstate under the current system. So I think that those two assumptions are big assumptions, and I think it significantly, with these amendments, I think it significantly reduces the financial impact. Then there's just one final thing that's different as far as the assumptions go. It talks about, further down, I think it's the eighth bullet point, assume a one-time $10 handling fee, and this is just kind of a minor change. The legislation proposed actually talks about a handling fee for each payment. So instead of being just a one-time handling fee, it'd be a two-time handling fee. And that's on page 3 on the amendment, starting at line 3.2, where it says a handling charge may be imposed for each installment payment. Those are the changes, I think, to the bill under the amendment that would significantly affect the fiscal note.
Okay, let's vote on the amendment, if that's okay, and at least get the bill in order that the author wants it, and then we can discuss the fiscal note and the bill. Is that all right, Representative Biskins, or do you want to? Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails. Now we have the bill in front of us, and we have a question, Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a series of questions, I think, but I'll try to be brief. First off, this applies to all DWIs, first time, et cetera.
Mr. Schwantes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Olin.
Second question, in the hypothetical, it happens a lot of times. So I get a DWI. I'm a relatively poor person. I may qualify for a public defender. I may not, but I just want to get it over, so I plead guilty. Does that mean I can't qualify for this because I pled guilty, never had the judge certify if I needed a public defender?
Mr. Schwantes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we were discussing this last Wednesday in front of the Senate committee, and I think the conclusion is that the person who wanted to reinstate could go back to the courthouse, fill out a public defender application, submit it to a judge or a financial screener that they have at the courthouse, and have them determine that they do qualify. So I do believe that it would still be available to people who, you know, just wanted to get the case over with and didn't realize that they might be eligible for this reinstatement installment plan later on.
But now what you're asking that person to do, who wanted to get it all done with the first time, realizes they made a mistake, now you're asking them to reappear in court again to fill out a form, so they have to go back a second time, even though they didn't want anything to do with the court system other than to get it done with them.
Mr. Schwantes.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative, I represent people every day that want to get things done with right away, and I encourage people every day to fill out a financial application to qualify for a public defender, because there's things that we can do to minimize the impact even if they want to get it over with. So I would say, you know, on the one hand, we help a lot of those people anyway, and they do apply. I don't think that there's a significant number of people that just want to get it over with and they miss us. I'm in court all the time, and I'm looking for those people. Secondly, for the small amount of people that, you know, didn't meet me and didn't get represented by me at that one court appearance where they wanted to get everything over with, you know, if it's worth it to them to be able to pay in installment payments, that's what they have to do. Sure.
Representative Olin.
I'm dealing with rural Minnesota. I was a prosecutor for 32 years, and believe me, there are a lot of people that want to plead guilty the first time in northern Minnesota and don't ever want to come back to that court again. And I think right now what you're doing, the way the bill presently reads, is penalizing them because they wanted to get it done the first time.
Right. Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin,
You know, I think you're right, but I think it would do us well to remember that this is for people who actually want to get their license reinstated. A lot of people that show up in my courtroom and your courtroom, they're like, whatever, I got caught. They don't care. They'll keep driving without a license. In this case, for those people that do want to make an effort to get reinstated, then it gives them an incentive to do that. And I would think that going out to filling a public defender eligibility form would be enough of an incentive for them to do that, aside from those folks who just don't care anyway, and they're not going to get reinstated.
But now you raised a real sore spot. Because unfortunately, most of the people I'm referring to are the poor people in northern Minnesota that are working on a job, absolutely need their license, and have nothing to do with not wanting to get their license back. And that I found offensive, to say most of them were.
If I may, Mr. Chair, and Representative, one thing that I know that happens a lot and that I do for clients a lot and my office does and my local court administration does is if someone wants to qualify for a public defender, we send them an application and we instruct them to fill it out and we tell them where to mail it. They mail it into the courthouse, judge looks over it and determines whether they qualify or not. So, you know, that would save a trip in. It can be done by mail, and it does get done by mail. And I understand the concern. I have that concern, too. You don't want to create even more hoops for people to jump through, but I think that's something that can be addressed and is addressed currently.
I think
Representative Olin,
I think there's a lot better way to handle it. I'm not sure exactly the wording, but I don't like having to have a person qualify for a public defender who maybe not only doesn't want to be in court a second time, but doesn't want to have to say they ever had to qualify for a public defender.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, this bill is an effort to help people who cannot afford to get their license back. We could just leave the program status quo and allow them to not get their license back or attempt to drive on a revoked license or what have you. But the entire point of it is to ensure that folks can get their license back when they otherwise wouldn't. I just wanted to clarify that.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A question or two for Mr. Schwanis. Stillwater Public Defender. I'm looking at the bill as amended and the language in DE1. If you take a look, first page, line 1.9. Am I reading this correctly? You're supporting a surcharge increase from $40 to $430?
Mr. Schwantes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely not. That's already been done. That already exists currently. Let me just explain. The original surcharge, the original, when you talk about the fee plus the surcharge, the original amount, the total amount that Minnesota citizens had to pay to get reinstated before July 1st, 2002 was $290. That's the $250 plus the $40 that you see on the on line 1.9. Then beginning July 1st, 2002, Minnesota citizens had to pay $250 plus a surcharge of $145 for a grand total of $395. That's already been done. That's already done and gone. Then, as of July 1st, 2003, the surcharge increased to $430. So that's $250 plus $430. That's at $680 that we're talking about right now. So right now, the fee and surcharge, the total fee and surcharge is $680. You know, our office wouldn't support that, but that's done and gone. That's what the fee is, and that's what it's been for the last over 3 years.
Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Representative Corner.
Huh? Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Schwartz, the 1.23 and 1.24, Mr. Schwartz, what does that do to the brain injury account? Does that decrease the amount that's going there? There's two lines overall when you look at the big picture here.
Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Over 1 year, it may. It could. But I think the fiscal impact is minimized when I talk about, when I explain the changes to the legislation. Essentially, I believe over 2 years, we're going to get more money than they currently get. And the reason they're going to get more money is because more people are going to be paying the reinstatements. There are going to be a portion of people that now reinstate that are paying it over 2 years instead of 1 year. And so that's why that number is different, because it's $50 that they would get out of, I mean, they're still getting $50 out of $680. And I think it's hard to predict what's going to happen in the future, except to say more people are going to reinstate. The number's going to go up from 29,000. More people are going to reinstate because this legislation affects people that aren't reinstating right now. So with that, line 1.23 is stating is for the people that are paying on installment payments, it is going to be $25 each year that the brain injury fund gets instead of $50 up front in 1 year. And that applies to the people that are doing the installment payment plan.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, rather than offer an amendment, now I just ask you to consider, is this going to be held over for possible inclusion?
I believe so. President Lesch, does it go anywhere else, or is it?
I believe this is just held over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to note, if I could, that Jeff Nackbar is here. I worked with him. He's with the brain industry, or I'm sorry, the brain injury folks, and he'd stated that this amendment was actually brought over to us from the Senate. He brought this over to my office, so he's okay with the language.
Representative Cornish.
Well, that was my concern with the brain injury people, because I've got an active group down in Mankato. I go to their meetings, and they always, their number one agenda is don't do anything to the brain injury account on the reinstatement. So thank you.
Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Representative Lesch or Mr. Schwantes, the fee on page 3-1 of the amendment, it's not defined in the bill or in the amendment. That concerns me. I'm just curious as how you come up with the $10 fee per payment. Why isn't it 25? Why isn't it 5? I guess I'm just curious, to, since it's not defined, how the $10 amount came about.
Mr. Schwantes, Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know. The legislation says handling charge, so it would seem that it would be up to the department to make the decision on how much they're going to charge for this. I think in their fiscal note, they just set it at $10. And again, they just set it at one $10 fee, and it would be two separate handling charges. And maybe that's something that should be specified in the legislation. I don't know.
Representative Zeller.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would prefer that rather than leaving it open. Representative Lesch, if you're open to that, maybe as we lay it over, just so that we have it defined, so that it's not a sliding, and as things kind of do around here, it never really slides backwards, they slide upwards. And then you mentioned, Mr. Schwantes, that this was just for first time, or is this just ongoing? First time offenders or ongoing offenders?
Mr. Schwantes.
Second or third offense, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, that's a great question, and I think the effect of this is going to be that the people that are going to avail themselves of this are going to be first time and maybe second time offenders. The thing is once you get beyond that, the repeat offenders have so many other sanctions that they're dealing with in terms of jail time and really long lengths of revocation. And then they have to prove rehabilitation, that once they get through all those hoops, if they're able to qualify for the reinstatement fee installment program, you know, great, but effectively there's so many other things that go into being able to get your license reinstated and so many other penalties that they're facing from DUI that I can't imagine that too many third and up DUI offenders are ever going to be able to fit under this. I really see this is applying to the person who makes a big mistake for the first time and is trying to avail themselves of it. But I don't think it should be excluded from people that have gone that long road back to be able to reinstate, because they've done a lot of extra things in form of jail sanctions, other sanctions, intensive supervision, home monitoring, ankle bracelets, all sorts of things to be able to come back to be in a position to get their license valid.
And Representative Eastland. Oh, actually, Mr. Chairman, I said one other follow-up. Yeah,
sorry.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Representative Lesher and Mr. Schwantes, the numbers and assumptions of who will apply, and I would never want to get in the dissection of a revenue note, either their assumptions or how they come to their conclusions, but I'm just curious as, you know, if you had any insight what, you know, if making a payment plan would make it easier, you know, I'm just curious as to how sometimes we overestimate in some cases, I think of the tax committee and how much we're going to supposedly bring in from compliance, you know. I just hope we're not setting ourselves up here for a pie-in-the-sky number and we're really not going to see it in the end.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I hear what you're saying. I can just tell you that when I'm in court and I have driving after revocation cases, I'm amazed at the number of people that have a driving after revocation that are eligible to reinstate right now. Well, what do you need to do? Oh, I have to pay the reinstatement fee. And I know I'm just speaking anecdotally, but I'm in court every day. I've been doing it for almost 10 years. And it's always being able to raise the money. It's not a lot of other things that they have to get done. You know, so I think if we can minimize the financial impact by doing this, I think you're definitely going to see that 29,000 number go up of DUI reinstatement significantly, and I think that has value, especially, again, considering that the amendment seeks, and I think it does address some of the concerns of the fiscal impact. But I honestly don't have any idea how much that number is going to increase. I think it is going to increase significantly, though.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that last question that Representative West asked, or Representative Zellers asked, was getting my issue. Oh yeah, there it is, Zellers. I guess I was going to come at it a little differently. How many people are not? Do we know how many people now are not reinstating? Do we kind of know that number? That are not choosing not to.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we believe that number is about 13,000 that is revoked for DUI and is not reinstated at this time. I also think that you know, we know that there's a substantial number, close to 40,000 driving after revocation charges a year, and we think that those charges would decrease greatly if people were able to avail themselves of this installment payment program. What happens when somebody takes up a driving after revocation in a county is they come to court, and oftentimes the court system wants the person to get valid, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sometimes 5 court dates for the person to come back every month or every 3 months just to tell the court whether they've been able to get valid or not, whether they've been able to raise the money or not. So I think that those case filings are going to decrease, those court appearances are going to decrease, and I think that's a separate cost savings that results.
Representative Chair, you said there's 13,000. Is that an annual kind of number, or is that a cumulative number?
Mr. Schwantes.
One moment. Mr. Chair, Representative, my information is that that number is an annual number of 13,000 people who are revoked and not reinstated yet.
And one more. So do we know anything about those people? How many of them actually do qualify for a public defender? So that's got to be kind of included in how the fiscal note was put together. I'm just trying to get the numbers in my head so I understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with you that is a number that we have to have. And it shouldn't be hard to get. I don't have the exact number right now. I'm not going to try to come up with a number. I can tell you that, again, we represent about 80% of all people charged with crimes. The DUI numbers are less, probably closer to 50%. A substantial portion of that 13,000 would qualify for this. I mean, maybe that number is 6,500. I don't know. But it's thousands of people that would qualify, to my estimation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the comments that Representative Olin made about the qualifying for public defender. First of all, I want to say that I think this is a very good idea, very well-intentioned. I mean, it's very important to allow people to get reinstated who are eligible. I mean, that's a goal that we should all share because we want people to be licensed. But I also am concerned about this provision that people have to be financially eligible for the public defender, and you didn't have that in the previous version, and I understand that you did that in order to reduce the fiscal note somewhat, but the fiscal note's changed already because of the other changes that were made in the DE, in the DE-1 amendment. And I guess that I think that having a, making a person qualify for the public defender in order to do this not only adds a layer of bureaucracy, as Representative Olin was talking about, but I think that a lot of the people who might need this might not qualify and, you know, are a little bit above needing qualifying for the public defender. And I just don't really, it just doesn't feel right to me to be making this kind of distinction in this area. And so I just wonder if Representative Lesh would be open to just removing that provision, making it open to everybody. And then I do think that it would be helpful to have a new fiscal note to so that we can see where we're really at, because I think it's been said here, it probably is changed quite significantly.
Representative Liebling, a new one has been requested. We should have it.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Will be requested. Representative Lash.
Mr. Chair, I think being the author of this bill, I am at least as concerned as anyone around this table as to the process by which people qualify for a public defender and how we do that now. I have substantial concerns with that process. What happens? Who is rightly entitled to free legal services, and who is not, and gets them anyway and depletes from the resources that otherwise legitimately indigent people are in. So I guess what I would say is, as it is now, we've done our best, as you've stated, correctly surmised that we've done this to reduce the fiscal note. It makes sense from a justice perspective that it is means-tested in some way, I believe, aside from the fact that it reduces the fiscal note. That said, I don't like the language as it stands anyway, but we did this as a compromise. Would I like to do that? Yes, but for the purposes of trying to get this through and getting a start at it, I'd like to leave it as is now for possible inclusion with some potential discussion later on as well.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a quick comment. Representative Liebling hit upon something that I was trying to get at. I'm not necessarily opposed to the way you have the bill now. When I heard the four-year, I was not very happy as a prosecutor. But the way it is written now, I'm not necessarily opposed to. I'm just trying to deal with the people that are right on the margin as far as the public defender that I know that I have in rural Minnesota that need their license badly because they've got to drive to work.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, just a quick question. Is this reinstatement of their full driving privileges or just as a work condition?
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, this is full restoration. You can also get a work permit, but that's a separate process.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Jeff Nockbar. I'm with the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota. And I just want to say, we were concerned initially with the impact of this on the Brain Injury Fund. And to the extent that we can get people who are not currently reinstating to reinstate, we think this is a good thing. More people will be driving legally. Ultimately, more people will be paying into the fund. There's no question that there will be an initial hit if we drop it from 50 to 25. We'd love it if you just left the 50 alone, but then everybody else would too, and I guess it's not fair to get into that. So, and to the extent that if we left it open for just anybody, the Traumatic Brain Injury Fund would take a serious hit. And so we would be opposed to just leaving it wide open. The fact that DWIs are expensive is, you know, clear, because it's a clear cost to the government and to all of our systems. And so to the extent that we can get people back on the road legally, help them rebuild their lives, keep these funds going, we don't have a problem with it. So I just wanted to make sure that that was clear.
Thank you for the question. President Coles.
Mr. Chairman, for the witness, I'm not terribly familiar with the Traumatic Brain Injury Fund. Is the fund used, and I looked at the bill here, is it used for services related to automobile and motorcycle accidents, or is it used more broadly? Are the services that you provide that are funded with this fund more broad than vehicle-related incidents?
Mr. Nachbar.
Chairman, Representative, yes, anybody in the state of Minnesota can get services through this. My understanding, and I wasn't here when it was originally created in 2003, was because of the connection between drunk driving and car crashes and the clear connection between car crashes and brain injury. And, you know, many of you were here for 2003 as they were trying to figure out how to pay for services, that it made sense to make that connection. So of that $50, the $50 goes to the health department, and then the health department does a registry, and then you can look at the language of how it's outlined. But in terms of the actual services, it's broad. It's available to anybody in Minnesota.
Any other questions of Mr. Nachbar? Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else want to testify on the bill? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat McCormick. I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And the division had some concerns with the original proposal, but we think that it would be workable unless it in the amendment that's been reviewed by the committee today. I think there's an issue of the handling fee that Representative Zellers brought up. We had initially read the bill to say that it was assumed, and maybe hadn't read it closely enough to assume it was a one-time fee. But in discussions at the committee meeting on the Senate side, realized that it was a fee that was to be to give the department some leeway in terms of trying to recover all the costs that it needs in order to comply with all the DWI laws and our reinstatement process. And so our estimate, we're looking at the Senate side right now for a fiscal note, and our estimate may be that handling fee for the first 2 years may need to be about $25 or $30 in order to recover our costs. But at the same time, Driver and Vehicle Services is a budget-based, it uses fees for its budget base. And so every 2 years, we review our fees to ensure that they're paying for the services. So at that point in time, if we recover the costs, then that would a fee that we would possibly reduce in terms of trying to administer the program, because in terms of our fiscal note, the first 2 years are the hard years for us in terms of keeping our current staff and driver compliance and our driver evaluator staff. So we think that we can work with the committee and Representative Lesh to make this work. The other point I just wanted to bring up is that it was discussed that there's about 13,000 people that are not reinstated each year. The division's numbers might be closer to 20,000 in terms of our estimates. So I just thought I'd bring that information for the committee to consider.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick, so is the $10 was per transaction, but then is that within, guesstimating, is that what it's going to cost you, basically?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, we think it'll be more like $25 during the first 2 years, just for us to keep our current staff, and with the fact that we are fee-based, we count on that revenue to support us, so we would need to cover costs for these first 2 years, while if there is the increase in the number of reinstatements, then we would be able to cut back on that, reduce that fee in the next biennium. It doesn't, at this point in time, it looks like it's up to our discretion in terms of what the fee would be, as it isn't in statute. My only concern with putting it any lower than that is it's going to be hard for us to cover our costs during this first two-year period. But certainly, our fees are always reviewed as part of every biennial budget, the budget process, and so we could bring that fee back to the for the legislature to consider in the next biennium.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick. So, and the payment plan, maybe this is actually for the author too, the payment plan would be initiated and housed in your department, not, you wouldn't farm out this, you know, to revenue or somebody else to work up the payment plan and keep track of it. It would be done in-house.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, yes, it would be done in-house. We would probably need a staff person in order to be able to, this will take quite a bit of additional record keeping on our part in terms of keeping straight who's paid and ones that people that haven't paid, especially if they have additional violations. But yes, we would not be, the way this bill is drafted versus what was drafted in previous years, this one would be able to be done within the division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Representative Lesh, final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just state that, as reiterate, that this is the intent of this bill, is to ensure that more people are in a position to get their licenses reinstated and thereby reduce our number of those types of driving after revocation, suspension, or cancellation offenses that come through our court system and needlessly take up time. It would have a beneficial impact on the court system as well, which is not reflected in this note or in this bill, but we think it's a matter of simple justice too, that you get more people qualified. With that, I would just ask for the support.
Very good. So we will lay House File 693 as amended on the table for lay over House File 693 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Keep your eye on your email for the joint committee meetings. If there's no other business before the committee, we adjourn. Thank you.